This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In the opening chapters of Little Dorrit, Arthur Clennam comes home after years spent abroad. Returning to the house in London where he passed his loveless childhood in the shadow of his mother's frowning, hell-bent nonconformism. His father is dead, his mother has had some sort of stroke and is confined to one room. The house is very old, built of brick somewhere in a warren of decaying streets between Cheapside and the filthy Thames. In the Phiz illustration it looks Baroque rather than Gothic. Dickens tells us it stands by itself inside a gateway beyond a courtyard where a few miserable shrubs grow inside the iron railings. There's been a problem with subsidence, and the house is propped up on one side with buttressing. Reading the bleak description of Clennam's home, we're in that delicious Dickens condition, where his words wrap us up in their consoling, saving surplus. The more desolate the description and the darker the shudder, the more snug the reading moment. He carries off this paradox, as few writers can, without it seeming a cheap trick, safe thrills. Here is Arthur looking round inside the house.
Dull and dark he found it. The gaunt rooms, deserted for years upon years, seemed to have settled down into a gloomy lethargy from which nothing could rouse them again. The furniture, at once spare and lumbering, hid in the rooms rather than furnished them, and there was no colour in all the house. Such colour as had ever been there had long ago started away on lost sunbeams, got itself absorbed, perhaps, into flowers, butterflies, plumage of birds, precious stones, what not. There was not one straight floor from the foundations to the roof. The ceilings were so fantastically clouded by smoke and dust that the old women might have told fortunes in them better than in grouts of tea. The dead-cold hearths showed no traces of ever having been warmed, but in heaps of soot that had tumbled down the chimneys and eddied about in little dusky whirlwinds when the doors were opened. In what had once been a drawing-room, there were a pair of meagre mirrors, with dismal processions of black figures carrying black garlands walking round the frames. But even these were short of heads and legs, and one undertaker like Cupid had swung round on his own axis and got upside down, and another had fallen off altogether. The room Arthur's deceased father had occupied for business purposes when he first remembered him was so unaltered that he might have been imagined still to keep it invisibly, as his visible relict kept her room upstairs. His picture, dark and gloomy, earnestly speechless on the wall, with the eyes intently looking at his son as they had looked when life departed from them, seemed to urge him awfully to the task he had attempted. Down in the cellars, as up in the bedchambers, old objects that he well remembered were changed by age and decay, but were still in their old places. Even to empty beer casks, hoary with cobwebs, and empty wine bottles, with fur and fungus choking up their throats. There, too, among unused bottle racks and pale slants of light from the yard above, was the strong room, stored with old ledgers, which had as musty and corrupt a smell as if they were regularly balanced, in the dead small hours, by a nightly resurrection of old bookkeepers.
I'm deeply stirred by this evocation of the old place, both as a piece of life and as a piece of writing. Novels and houses, novels and rooms, seem to me to have been wrapped up together from the beginning of the novel's history. There was a lot of worry in the 18th century about the corrupting influence of novels on susceptible young people who took them off to read in the suspect privacy of their chambers. The ideas of privacy and of solitary reading being fairly new at that time. Novels written in rooms and read in them. It's no wonder that the room has a sort of metaphorical primacy inside so many novels, certainly in Dickens. A room appears as the shape of a life, its outward manifestation. Its furnishings are the accumulated signs of a thick personal history. This system of signs, a room as a life as a room, isn't just a literary conceit, it's a conceit sustained by an outward reality. Look around you, at the room you're in. It's not just fanciful that the rooms in the Clenham home have sunk into a gloomy lethargy, or that the blackened cupids around the mirrors cavort as if they're in funeral processions. These outward signs are the real consequences of the years in which no one has visited them, dusted them, reupholstered or repainted them. Because Mrs. Clenham and her sidekick Flintwinch have shut out the world of real things and devoted themselves instead to the fantasies which consume them inwardly. The getting of money, the grinding condemnations of a dark religion, Mrs. Clenham's inability to let go of her jealousy of her dead husband. This endless interpenetration, backwards and forwards, of the represented real of solid things and facts, with mood and spirit and meaning, seems to me the richest resource of literary realism. There isn't really any bare realism without a metaphoric reverberation, although great writers of the opposite bent to Dickens have tried for it sometimes, tried to empty their language of its overstuffed accumulations of significance. Metaphor dogs the heels of the plainest narrative account, as if the very basis of perception were metaphorical. The stuff we see, just as much as the words making up our sentences, throbs with more meaning than itself, whether we like it or not. And if we do like it, then it's the great excitement of this kind of writing, dreaming up and setting down the precise substantiating details of a place, or of a person, or of a moment of relationship, in the exact right words. Feeling, if we can get the detail right, mysterious life begin to stir in the words on the page or the screen in front of us. The satisfaction is as much sensual as intellectual. If I go over my writing in my mind after I've finished it, it's more often than not the thought of the stuff, the solidities, that makes my heart race, rewards labour with pleasure. Striped flannelette sheets, or a spilled potato gratin, or the greasy cleanser on a naked face. I imagine Dickens dwelling luxuriantly for a moment, the evening after he'd written them, on those wonderful mirrors, whose extensions of significance seem almost infinite, reflecting back and forward, even while they remain solidly themselves. A pair of meagre mirrors, with dismal processions of black figures carrying black garlands walking round the frames. Meagre is superbly right. What can it mean? Is it size? Was there penny-pinching in the original purchase? I don't think it's that. It's what's happened to them over time. They're meagre because they're tarnished and foxed with damp and age. They let so little light into their glass and reflect so little of the nothing that passes in front of them. There's something in the rhythm of the Dickens sentences, in their virtuosic flourish and sheer display, that seems to demand reading out loud. The ceilings were so fantastically clouded by smoke and dust that the old women might have told fortunes in them better than in grouts of tea. The dead cold hearths showed no traces of ever having been warmed, but in heaps of soot that had tumbled down the chimneys and eddied about in little dusky whirlwinds when the doors were opened. Such fantastical flights of fancy and elaborate rhetorical detours would sound mannered and arch. Overdone, I think, if a writer tried them now. If the novel form was in at the beginning of the practice of solitary reading, then since then we've retreated much farther indoors and into subjectivity. We mostly write more quietly these days, a much more inward prose. There's a moment in my novel The London Train that fits so neatly alongside Arthur Clennam's tour round his parental home that I'm almost inclined to accuse myself of an unconscious echo. My heroine Cora is in lonely possession of her parental home, looking round its rooms at night, feeling its emptiness. The mirror was old, foxed, and antique, divided in portions like a triptych, in a thin, cracked, gilt frame. In the empty grate beneath, a fan of folded gold paper was arranged with some pine cone sprayed gold. But my sentences are rhythmically so much thinner and plainer. I've deliberately chosen that percussive, slightly fractured punctuation, a reiterative hard sputter of words that won't flow, can't be read sonorously. Nowadays we find sonority in writing false. Sincerity sounds different in different eras. I've also removed the author from view in my sentences, made myself appear to do less work, made my assembly of items seem minimally functional, as bare as an inventory. Though, in truth, I am casting about for some of the same metaphorical resonances with my mirror as Dickens has achieved with his. In the Little Dorrit passage, the author is at the centre. He's the star turn, the alchemist, translating the bare matter of his stuff into something not itself, something full of life and stir in the dead house. Those old women reading tea leaves, the soot eddying on the hearth. And something's shifted between Dickens' time and now, in the relationship between the author and the concrete detail. Conjuring up the furniture in a room, part of its power for me is in its separate, though of course imaginary, existence, independent of the story. The mirror is, in its moment, provided for Cora to see herself, but I feel the rag bag of my detail mustn't be enlisted too explicitly as part of any theme. We're more at home than the Victorians with randomness and accident. In fact, we're suspicious if everything's sewn too fluently together. Actually, I think these days we find the arbitrary solidity of things, a mirror, a painted pine cone, consoling, touching. It's interesting that I have Cora look at herself in the mirror in my book, depressed by what she sees. When I tried to imagine Arthur looking at himself, I couldn't. It was very odd. Of course Arthur has a developed subjectivity, a rich selfhood in Little Dorrit. And yet he didn't seem, when I tried, to have the kind of subjectivity that could see itself in a mirror. Cora's a child of the 20th century. She knows all about mirrors. She'll have seen Magritte and Tarkovsky. She'll have heard of Lacan, though she won't have read him any more than I have. When Arthur was put together, he wasn't given the self-consciousness to interrogate himself at that level. We're privy, and movingly, to a lot of his depression and self-doubt, but his doubt is innocent compared to Cora's. He doesn't watch himself having it. He doesn't know himself. We need Dickens to know him. Is the innocence of Dickens' characters problematic? He's a great comic writer, profoundly funny, and yet irony isn't allowed anywhere near the core of his stories. Nowhere near, for instance, his heroine, Little Dorrit, the prison child, impossibly good and always putting herself last. In a modern novel, we wouldn't believe in her. We'd be sure she was up to something, acting out some fantasy of her superiority. To a hostile reading, Dickens' moral universe could seem infantilized and sentimental, dangerously invested in a dream of chaste, good women. And yet the reading experience at its most powerful can put us into relationships with its material that go deeper than moral judgment. Imaginatively, we can enter moral worlds that are not our own. Just as readily as we can inhabit, say, Flaubert's landscape of cool unbelief, we can make ourselves at home inside this Dickens place, with its yearning earnestness, its passionate imagination of home and good and love. The wholeness of the place is constituted for us through the brilliant overspill of Dickens' imaginative energy and comic spirit, and through his grounding in the materiality of actual things, crooked floors and beer casks hoary with cobwebs and pale slants of light.